Hello and welcome to PI in a Pod, the podcast that examines the pension industry's biggest issues. I'm Jenica Darby, Insight Editor at Pensions Insight magazine, and today I'm here with Ros Altman, Pensions Champion and former Pensions Minister. It's great to have you with us today, Ros, especially at a time when the pensions industry is going through a period of such tumultuous change, as you have some really unique insights into what's going on. First of all, could you just shed some light on your experiences over recent years of your time as Pensions Minister, but also as a Pensions Champion?
Well, I've always worked in one way or another throughout my career on pensions, and I have treated pensions as an issue that's not just about products or money, it's mm-hmm. about people. So I guess the highlights of what I've done in the past would focus on having helped people get better pensions in one way or another. Mm-hmm. But it seems that all too often within government and within the official circles, not enough is understood about how people think or what people need. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the biggest challenges, you know, communicating pensions in ways that ordinary people can relate to is not something that is a strong suit of government or officials, and it needs to be, in my view. Mm-hmm.
So during your time as Pensions Minister, you had said that you often felt silenced over a number of key issues. What, now that you've stepped down from that position, is your biggest priority, and what do you feel that you can more passionately focus on now?
I think there are still a number of issues that are really important to help people understand, help the government get right. Mm-hmm. Obviously, pensions tax relief is a big issue, and changing the landscape to make pensions work better for more people mm-hmm. is something that reform of pension incentives could actually achieve. To be fair, a number of the roadblocks might have also been compounded by the pre-referendum mm-hmm. period. And I had originally hoped that after the referendum was out the way, and as you know, I campaigned passionately to remain, mm-hmm. That it would be easier politically to get things done. Mm-hmm. However, nobody seemed to have predicted the vote and the result that came out of it. So at the end of the day, it's going to be even harder to get room for major changes, because there's so much else on the agenda. I would like to still try and help people affected by the net pay issue, mm-hmm. the lowest earners who are being denied tax relief and basically forced to pay about a 20% penalty mm-hmm. for their pensions. Obviously want to make sure master trusts are secure currently. Mm-hmm. They're not. Possibly trying to help women who lose out on their state pension, as well as obviously they lose out on private pensions if they have interrupted careers or lower earnings than men. But there are mostly women who work part-time and may have jobs that don't allow them to qualify for national insurance, and because they're working they don't get credited either. I started some work on that. I hope that we can help the government see that we need to continue that, because it really is just not fair, and we need to improve pension outcomes for women and low earners particularly.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Brexit just earlier. What are your thoughts on how that's going to affect the state of pensions? Obviously, unfortunately, pensions are going to take a bit of a backseat for a while because Brexit and the outcome is going to take priority. But how do you think it might affect pensions long term?
Well, actually, the referendum result has already affected pensions insofar as interest rates have plummeted again, long-term interest rates have plunged. Mm-hmm. So defined benefit pension scheme deficits have increased significantly further since the vote. And then you had the Bank of England increasing its QE operations. That really does worry me, because I think that is terribly bad news for pensions. And anyone buying an annuity now mm-hmm. is getting worse and worse value, but they will never recover. Even if interest rates go back up again, you've locked into today's rate, so mm-hmm. you'll never get a better pension later on. And that is a problem. But as far as other issues relating to pensions are concerned, I think we do need to see what happens to the economy. I must admit that I find it very difficult to see how the economy can thrive in an environment where we're trying to negotiate leaving Europe. I hope I'm wrong. But anything that weakens the economy would normally weaken pensions.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we'll have to see. We haven't left yet, and we've still got a long way to go before we know what the landscape is going to look like.
And honing in on DC pensions and the generational split with pension savings, how do or how can the pensions industry redress the balance between old and young people in pensions? How can they tackle that problem?
I don't know if the pensions industry has a role to differentiate in quite that way. But I certainly think that there is a big job of work to do to engage people of all ages in pensions. I suppose it depends what you mean by young and old, but whether you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, or 50s, it is important that the pensions industry helps you understand why pensions are so important, why they're so good for you, and how to engage with them. Maybe you need a different approach for people who own their own homes or who don't own their own homes, not so much by chronological age, but by circumstance. Maybe you need more digital approaches for the younger people who are digitally savvy, but don't forget the people who might not be, and still make sure that you have approaches for them. But this is just general customer care. You know, any retail company will have, or should have, strategies for appealing to different types of customer. In a way, maybe the pensions industry has typically treated everybody as the same sort of person. And customers would be considered as a sort of homogenous group. And maybe we need to be looking at ways in which we can stratify customers in the same way as retail people do. And that might be by, you know, gamification for younger people, or specific advertising that recognises, you know, if you've got student debt, for example, or if you don't yet own a house, or if you are renting, there are still reasons why you might want to think about being in a workplace pension, for example. You know, saving and the importance of saving is something that's been devalued in the current low interest rate environment. But there's still more we can do to try and help people still retain the understanding of why it's quite important to save.
Yeah, and you mentioned there targeting different audiences based on their perhaps their needs at the time, so whether they were saving for a house or whether they were dealing with student debt. The lifetime ISA will be brought in to perhaps address that to some extent. What are your thoughts on it, and do you think it may have a detrimental effect on auto-enrolment as a result?
Lifetime ISAs are a really dangerous product, and I hope that there will be rethought. Yes, having a product that helps people save to buy a house is important. We already had the Help to Buy ISA. I know it wasn't designed terribly well, and that's another example of how whoever was designing it didn't quite understand how the real world works and how people's lives go. But having said that, to try and confuse saving for a house with saving for retirement is very unhelpful. Auto-enrolment is about retirement savings and later life savings and having money in your 80s and 90s. Help to Buy ISAs and this so-called lifetime ISA is at best about saving to buy a house, in which case let's keep that separate from what you might want to save for much longer term. But also, it will give you money at age 60, tax-free, So this lifetime ISA is not going to last a lifetime.
No.
You know, it is going to have all the incentives for you to spend that money way before you reach later life, proper later life, when you really do need the extra income. I mean, many people will still be working at age 60.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a tax-free lump sum on offer, the chances are most people will just take it out. We see that at the moment, almost everybody takes their tax-free lump sum from their pension fund. That's only a quarter. Even if they don't need it, they take it out. And very often before the budget, you get these stories going around, take your tax-free cash as soon as you can because the government may take it away from you. Well, this is only a quarter of the fund with a so-called lifetime ISA. That's the whole lot.
Absolutely.
So taxpayers will be spending an awful lot of money today subsidising a savings fund for people to spend at age 60. Where is the social rationale in that?
Absolutely. And I think we're hearing more and more about longevity risk, and I don't think people really understand just how long we're going to live. And certainly younger people don't think about being old. They don't think about how much money they're really going to need being old. But I think if you did ask a young person what they were going to do in retirement, they would say go on lovely holidays and buy a nice car. And I don't think people think about how they would fund that, let
yes.
alone how they would fund basic necessities such as food and,
yeah.
and heating. And I think that's a real problem. And maybe the lifetime ISA being offered out as a house-saving vehicle is just going to make that problem worse.
Yeah.
Because young people will automatically focus on buying a house because it's not instant gratification, but it's far more instant than retirement.
But example. That's fine, as long as you don't opt out of your workplace pension as well.
Absolutely.
So, you know, if you put a bit of money into the workplace pension and you put some money into a house-saving product, that's okay too.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't mind seeing some design concept that looked at the workplace savings plan whereby the employer contribution and tax relief is locked
mm-hmm.
for retirement, but maybe for student debt and or for house purchase, your own money could be taken out. You know, that is
That's
something that we could design.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a lot better than this whole idea of a lifetime ISA.
Mm-hmm.
But it does add complexity. So providers would need to get their head around how that might work. You'd have to keep track of the separate pots.
Mm-hmm.
But the lifetime ISA has got so many aspects that I feel are really dangerous, including the penalty for taking the money out early. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the reason why people who are opting out of a workplace pension scheme might be tempted to do so, even if they decide they don't want to save for a house but want to use this savings product, is because of the idea that they might be able to get their money if they need it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, actually, that's not what you want. But with this huge penalty, around 5% or even more being taken back from your savings, I can just see in a few years' time people claiming they were missold this product. This is a complicated product. It cannot be sold simply and carelessly. And my fear is that it's not like other ISAs.
Mm-hmm.
Other ISAs are sold without too much regulatory constraints. If you try and sell a lifetime ISA like that, you are opening up the floodgates to a future mis-selling scandal. We don't need that. You know, we want to get away from all of that. And ISA also usually is invested in cash. Most people would put their ISA in cash savings. And if you're saving for a house, there's a rationale for that,
mm-hmm.
to some degree at least. But if you're saving for 40 years, you're bound to have less money later on if you save it in a cash fund than if you save it in a different type of long-term investment fund.
Mm-hmm.
Again, who is going to explain that to people? Who is going to help people understand what they're giving up if they go into a lifetime ISA and what the consequences are and what the risks are? So I do have a lot of concerns about muddying the waters for pensions. Auto enrollment is going well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to derail it. And I do hear from people who are saying, we don't know, should we opt out of our workplace pension to put money into this lifetime ISA thing? You know, what's this all about?
It's worrying times, I think. And I think with the implementation date of LISAs coming ever closer, I think it'll be interesting to see how the industry deals with it and the products that come forward from it in time for I think it's April 2017
at the moment.
Not that far away.
I am certainly not surprised to hear a number of providers say they're just not interested in providing it. Mm-hmm. And if I was a provider, I would not be interested in selling this carelessly to people. If you only sell it through advisors, it's a different matter. Mm-hmm. But how many young people have an advisor?
Barely any, I'd imagine. And I think if they were told they had to incur an additional cost to use an advisor, it just becomes ever more off-putting, doesn't it?
And there are no controls on the charges in these lifetime ISAs. So, you know, a lot of things about it just really worry me. I think if you want to buy a house, have a help to buy or a house purchase ISA. But if you want a pension has the right behavioural pushes. Mm-hmm. By having taxed income in later life, it stops you from spending it too soon. Mm-hmm. You will think twice before taking a lot of money out. With a lifetime ISA, you know, you might think, oh, I'm 60 and I've got this tax-free sum, so I'll have a lovely holiday now and I'll buy my new car now. If you try and do that out of a pension, you lose a significant chunk mm-hmm. in tax, so you probably wouldn't do it. And certainly if you understood it, you wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. But the incentive is completely the other way around with an ISA. The incentive is to spend it as soon as you possibly can, mm-hmm. as soon as you can get your hands on the tax-free money. With pensions, you can safely just leave it for much later in life, and there are good reasons for you to think about doing that.
Mm-hmm. And then last of all, if you were to give the new pensions minister, or undersecretary, if you like, one piece of advice, what would it be?
Make sure that you don't just do what your officials tell you to do. Ask questions and try to understand the people at the end of the policies that you are making.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like sound advice to me. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Ros. That's
thank
great.
You.
Thank you very much.